The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We've got a 2 hours chock full of really interesting conversation for us all. Of course, we'll start off with finding out what hasn't happened at Mayor Sheila Dixon's trial. But before we get to all that, we're going to take a very short break to take you over to WEAA traffic and make sure you get home safe and sound. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. We have plenty to talk about today. We're going to look at what's going on in the trial of Sheila Dixon. Not much. A lot, but nothing we know about. And we'll talk to reporters Melody Simmons and Charles Robinson in just a minute. Then we'll be talking with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, who Time Magazine has named one of the 10 best college presidents in the nation. Of course, he's president of UMBC and is just one of the most amazing human beings on the planet Earth. It's amazing and wonderful that we have him here in this community. We're going to talk to him about many things during the course of the hour. And then we're going to talk about everything from why Sarah Palin and President Barack Obama both have the same approval ratings and what that means for America at large and what this debt means and why people are so upset about jobs and who's getting money in America and who's not. But first, we're going to turn in a minute to our two reporters. I want to remind you that Urbanite Radio Stories on the Mark Steiner Show are made possible by National Connections Academy, an accredited online private school with affordable tuition for grades K through 12. Visit nationalconnectionsacademy.com for more information. And as I said, I'm Mark Steiner here right now with Melody Simmons, who is a reporter for the Mark Steiner Show and Center for Emerging Media and WEAA, and Charles Robinson, who's correspondent for Maryland Public Television's State Circle. Melody, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Mark. Good to be here.
So, Melody, what's going on?
Well, today was another slow day, waiting for the jury. 7 hours they deliberated again. There were no notes today. There was one toward the end of the day, around 4:30, but close to 4 o'clock, the judge summoned one attorney from each team into his chambers to talk to them about the protocol. What should we do? Should he have the jury stay late today? And the reason is that tomorrow is a state furlough day, and the state prosecutor's office is on furlough, which is unpaid leave. And so if the jury, which the courts are open tomorrow, and if the jury were to come back and deliberate tomorrow, the state prosecutors would come to monitor that and be make an appearance in court at no, you know, without pay. So The way things stand is that they will report again tomorrow at 9 a.m., to continue deliberations.
But there is a possibility then that they may not because of the furlough?
No, they will be back tomorrow at 9 a.m.
Charles, you there? Charles Robinson? I understand he's on the line, right?
Mark, you there?
Yeah, Charles, I'm here.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting because as you've already heard, they are coming in tomorrow. But if they continue deliberations, that means they would have Thursday off, Friday off, and they would have the whole weekend off and come back on Monday. I think that's a long time for a jury to think about a case.
They won't deliberate on Friday?
They would not deliberate on Friday.
It's a court holiday. On Friday. Mm-hmm.
So this is interesting. But clearly, they've been wrestling. This jury is wrestling over a number of very key issues. And Melody, if you could just first, and have Charles comment. You've been watching these notes going in and out of the court. Perhaps you have too,
yeah.
Charles Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of the sequence of the questions may lead us to what they've been deliberating about and what went first and what they've come down to.
Well, it looks like they're just trying to look at all of the evidence, look at all of the testimony, consider the legal jargon and the legal meanings. They once, at one point asked for a legal dictionary. They were denied it by the judge. But as we talked about last week, the verdict sheet is very confusing. There are certain charges you can find guilty on one, but you have to find innocent on the other. So there's a lot of contingencies, and I think that is, kind of like a maze that the jury is navigating right now. We really don't know for sure. Everything is speculation. We're kind of like sideline, working from the sidelines, but that's the way it looks.
Charles?
This is not unusual. I mean, if you want to look at some precedent, if you will, I think, everybody looks towards the Marion Barry case. It took a jury 8 days to reach a verdict in that trial. If you look as far back as the Mandel case, which was probably one of the most highest profile political cases in the state, it took up to 14 days. I always, having sat on jury trials, I've kind of gotten into a mode, don't read too much into what they're asking for, because a lot of times, it's for clarification. I often say that if they come back with a quick verdict, I think that always kind of favors the prosecution. They basically have read the evidence. But, this is a different kind of case. It's so nuanced, I've talked about, the jury instructions. I mean, they're baffling. And I've got to believe that's part of it. In other words, you can find the mayor guilty of one thing, but you can't find it guilty of another thing, or if you combine the two. And those are just tough things to deal with, especially when there's not a lot of evidence, but there's enough evidence there that you could possibly read it two different ways, depending on your train of thought. And remember that, despite the fact that the jurors are not supposed to, watch any television, I believe one of the jurors said this past weekend she went to the Hun restaurant where they were doing the Pink Flamingo outside, and she happened to see the mayor. And, look, you live in this town, you're going to run into people. And I can tell you, I was at a bar on Friday night, not that that's what I always do, but, it was a topic of conversation.
Everybody's talking about it. I think people are speculating. As Charles said, it's not unusual for a jury to take a lot of time with the case. This case has a lot of meaning, not only to Mayor Dixon and her career and her pension and her future, but it also has a lot of meaning to the city. And I think that the jury is being conscientious. They're taking their time and they're weighing all the facts.
I was looking on some website. They haven't said, but BL said that they've sent the jury home.
Mm-hmm.
So they will be in tomorrow. I guess, it's almost difficult to even have something to say about it until we see what happens tomorrow.
Well, I think one of the things that's been interesting is that how the attorneys have commented after each day the case has gone on. I think early on that Werner was pretty confident that, his client was probably getting a fair shake. I think the comments that he gave yesterday were a little bit more guarded. The prosecution has kind of stayed mum, in the sense that, when they make a comment, it's kind of like, we'll see what the jury does. And, because I think, despite the fact that a jury is not being sequestered, in other words, they usually shut out everything around them and all they get to do is deal with the case. The fact that these folks have been home at least one time and I think the judge instructed them, go out and relax a little bit, when they got that note back that said, it's getting a little heated in here. That showed kind of the personalities of some of the jury. We don't know, who was. And remember, and Melanie, when the judge got a couple of notes, he asked them, send the notes to the foreperson, not just send them individually. Because I think that the judge felt as though it was getting away from the jurors. In other words, I think he was trying to stop camps from being set up. In other words, maybe you have a particular issue that you like and that you felt very strongly about it, and then there was others who said, I felt strongly about another issue. But, that's all speculation.
Well, right now, I think everything is speculation.
Right.
Nobody. So, tomorrow morning, I guess, the jury will reconvene, and well, stay in touch with you, Melody Simmons, and Charles Robinson, and see what transpires during the day. And we'll come on tomorrow at 5 o'clock live for a few minutes to give a wrap-up, or we'll have a long discussion about the results of the jury, whether they convicted Mayor Sheila Dixon or not, and on what counts.
Okay.
So, I'm sorry, Melody?
No, that sounds good.
All right.
I think that we will hear the jurors. I think some of them will talk to the media, so we're going to get an inside view of the deliberation, hopefully after it's all over.
Melody Simmons, thanks for reporting for us. Charles Robinson, thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you both tomorrow and see what's going on.
Great.
Thanks, Mark.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So there's no news, and rather than kind of talk on about something we can't really talk about until we know what goes on, we'll move on to a conversation that I think will have substance for the day. And we are about to be joined by Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, of course, is president of the University of Maryland-Baltimore County, UMBC, and was named by Time Magazine as one of the 10 top college presidents in the United States, who's turned UMBC into an amazing institution, 17 years at the helm of that institution, and a mathematician in his own right, among many other things. Doesn't do bad on the piano with Chopin either, from what I remember wafting from his house when he used to live in Windsor Hills. Freeman Hrabowski, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark, very much.
Been practicing your Chopin, have you?
No, I haven't. Not as much as I need to. I need a lot of practice.
Well, it's great to have you with us. And congratulations.
Thank you.
That's well deserved. When I look at what's going on at UMBC and I look at the travails that people have in college, I mean, there's something you've brought to the institution, kind of a positive sense of what can be done. Because we see, especially among African-American and Latino students and Native American students and a lot of minorities in this country who kind of fall apart in large colleges and don't make it through for numbers of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things people talk about in historically black colleges, and a lot of colleges I've visited on Indian reservations, is that students who make it there make it because of the support system that is underneath of them. How much of that has to do with the success at UMBC?
I think a lot of the success at UMBC can be attributed to the supportive faculty and staff who were there. I had the privilege of being at our student senate meeting last night, and I just observed our students as they interacted. And the first thought was that they come from all over the world. Keep in mind, we have students from 150 countries on that campus, many of whom have parents who've moved to this country. Many are first-generation American students. And so we have a lot of international and domestic diversity. I mean, in addition to the students from all over the world, we have about 14% African-American students, about 3% Hispanic, almost 4% now, and some Native Americans. But what's significant, at about 22-23% Asian-American. So you've got that kind of diverse background in a supportive setting. What is significant about the award to me is it's about the university. It's not about one person. It's about all of the faculty and staff members who've given their careers to building a climate of academic excellence and support for students so that those students can excel and so that faculty and students together can work on research. So it is the supportive environment that makes the difference.
You started the Meyerhoff program a long time, what was it, 15 years ago?
Right. Bob and Jane Meyerhoff were co-founders. They were wonderful philanthropists. And it's actually been 20 years. It was in 1988, the first students came in 1989.
Really?
And amazingly, there are students from those first groups now who are now teaching at Harvard and University of Michigan and at Hopkins, people with MD, PhDs, and Duke. So the program has done well. And what makes it especially significant in the country is we now have students of all races coming through that program focused on issues involving underrepresented groups in America.
So, people are still wrestling in America over underachievement by African-American students.
Mm-hmm.
And just getting to the crux of why and how to turn it around.
Right.
This is something you've been deeply involved in, something you talk about a lot.
Sure.
Lecture about a lot.
Sure.
And I help for our audience here. And by the way, folks, you can join us at 410-319-8888 as we talk with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, president of UMBC. about talk a bit about how you see America, how you see we should tackle this problem, because it really is multifaceted. I mean, there's, on the one hand, you're dealing with kids who come from inner city neighborhoods that are completely desolate, and where the education is not even part of the social fabric.
Mm-hmm.
You're also talking about kids who are coming from middle class and upper middle class homes in the city and in Baltimore County and other communities like that around the country.
Right.
And achievement is still under in those communities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Talk about the root of that for a minute and what you do to...
It's a great question, Mark. You know, when I talk about the achievement gap around the country, I talk about it on two levels. First of all, we need to do more to help all of our children excel. It's not just students of color who are not doing well.
Right.
Large numbers of white children, low-income, working-class, and even middle-class children are not necessarily doing as well. And when you compare our performance to that of students in other countries, you see that there is an achievement gap between our very best and the best in some other countries. That's the first issue. But even more fundamental, as you say, we do have a challenge of so many of our students not doing well. And at the heart of the challenge, I believe, would be reading skills. And I'm speaking as somebody who has focused on math for a long time. If you give me a child who can read well, I can teach her to do mathematics and to do story problems. And we have a major challenge in our country to of increasing the number of children, of making sure that all of our children learn to read and to love to read, that they want to be smart, that they want to get that work, and that they understand that it's very hard to make it in today's world without an education. And that's a challenge that we face in all of our communities, whether it's suburban, rural, or inner city, whether it's Baltimore or out in California.
So, but what are we missing here in America? I mean, why is all of a sudden, why have our test scores gotten mediocre and gone flat, while other parts of the world have continued, have grown?
Right. It's interesting. We're not making some of the progress, and there are a lot of factors. And I mean, what I would tell you is that we need more people bringing the kind of rigor to this discussion that we see when we're looking at issues of health care and the economy right now. These are not easy problems to solve. There is a role for everyone to play. My books focus on helping parents understand what they can do to help students succeed. We need to be giving teachers as much support as possible. It's very easy to blame a teacher when, in many cases, the teacher needs support in understanding how best to work with those children. So what I would say is that there's a multi-pronged approach that we need to be taking. And we can only do that if we have the kind of rigorous thinking involved in trying to solve those problems. Now, what we've done at the university is twofold. Number one, we do work with students and children from Baltimore County. Our CHOICE program works with first-time offenders. We have hundreds of children we supervise 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We bring a lot of those kids to campus. We're working with them on reading skills and tutoring and helping them to want to one day go to college. And there are a variety of other programs like that. At the same time, we're working to get more students interested in and teachers to understand what we're going to need to be doing. So a Center for History Education, for example, focused on helping teachers look at how they're working with children to understand the worldview and to move beyond the Western perspective to understand Asia and other parts of the world. And so we've got a variety of programs in the arts, in the humanities, in science and engineering, all focused on pre-college teaching and learning as we work to build the cadre of students who can come to UMBC and excel.
The question, though, is, there's something... I mean, when you have examples of 10, 20 institutions in America, yours, that are really doing some things to advance education and turn things around and mold young people into the scientific and artistic leaders of tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like I'm talking about on a mass level in America. Maybe it's too hard to function that way. Maybe we have to function institution by institution. But something is amiss in America.
Yes. And yeah, I don't disagree. I do think that the new efforts, more and more efforts focused on getting college students and high school students involved in community service will be very important. A part of the challenge is to help Americans understand that our responsibility to ourselves and to our communities is to get involved. And to spend time working to help with children. Now, is that the only part of the solution? No. I mean, there are some more comprehensive issues. I mean, going all the way back to thinking about poverty and how we help to empower people to focus on the challenges that they're facing, but give them the support they need, because people need jobs. Let's start there. We know that it's hard to do anything else if you don't have a job, so you can help take care of your children. You've got a real challenge. So I mean, from job training to housing issues to focusing on education, I do think that there's a need for all of us to become far more passionate about the value of education. I often ask people, where would any of us be if we hadn't had a chance to get a good education? You know, and growing up in Birmingham, what I heard all the time, you've got to be educated. You've got to get a good education. The only way you can make it in this world. But we have to have that kind of passion in all of our communities as we think about ways of helping children to want to be smart. But it will take a culture change. You know, when we think about American Idol those kinds of programs, and it's great to have people doing well in those areas, but how do we have American Idols who are getting a great education in literature or history or in science? We need to think about who our role models are and what our values are. So there's some very fundamental discussions that we have to have over a long period of time to get us all to rethink what is important to us in American society. And one of the things I would say about UMBC, and I've got to go back to my colleagues, is that we are discussing the sticky issues of the day, whether it's about poverty or race or gender discrimination or the need to make sure we give everybody a solid foundation in the humanities and social sciences to understand this increasingly technological world. We're talking about those issues, and we need to be preparing leaders and professionals who will feel that sense of responsibility to people who didn't have the advantages that they had.
Let me give you a concrete example of some things I'm thinking about in education and where we're going, and I want folks to join us if you wish at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com as we talk with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, who's president of UMBC and has been named one of the top 10 college administrators in the United States of America. 410-319-8888, and we're exploring what's going on that is positive in our education, but what we have to do and why so many of our children are not making the grade, and what your thoughts are about that, especially about children who come from the African-American world and where education is the key in how to get that sense back and make it a success. 410-319-8888 as we talk with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski. So I was thinking about a discussion I had the other night with some people about literature.
Yes.
And teaching of literature in schools.
Uh-huh.
And so a teacher said, you know, we have to find books that relate to the children so they will read them. And I said, well, what does that mean? Does that mean that the only books it's important that we now have to have literature that comes from all the cultural parts of America,
mm-hmm.
so the black authors and Native American authors and women authors and Latino authors are
right.
in our curriculum so people can feel the diversity of literature.
Yeah.
But does that mean that all of a sudden that we're going to narrow things down, that if you're black, we only bring books that are about the black world and by black authors? And but that's what we're doing, it seems.
I can't speak to what any particular system is doing. I can talk about what we work to do at UMBC, what I had as a child. My mother was an English teacher. And of course, I learned Langston Hughes poems and read Ralph Ellison, but she also made sure I read Dostoevsky and Emily Dickinson. So, I mean, the broader one's reading experience, the more one understands about human nature. It is great for students to have problems, math problems, or to read things that the student can relate to immediately, but it's also critical that we teach children that the world is bigger than Baltimore or bigger than America, that there are issues and challenges and wonderful experiences all over the world. And so, now I'm a strong believer in giving that broad education, teaching people to appreciate their own culture, but also to understand others. And that's why what we do at UMBC, I think, is so important. When African-American students and Asian-American students and students who were reared in Russia come together, and students from Baltimore and students from Barbados, and can talk about their different experiences, they begin to see a bigger world and to understand their place in the world, not just in America. We've got to prepare students to live in a world that will involve people from all over. I mean, one of the interesting responses I got to a question I want to tell you about somebody asked the question, what course should every American take? And somebody suggested comparative religion. Well, I think it's a great answer. We need to be explaining and helping students understand the perspectives of different religions, just as we talk about different cultures, because these, the more we understand about what others do and how they do it, the more we can appreciate what we have to do ourselves. And that's why the work that we do on our campus in the humanities and the social sciences and the arts is critical to preparing people for whatever career they're going to have, especially as they work to focus on the kinds of problems you're talking about. If we're going to solve the sticky issues, to address the sticky issues of education and underachievement or what students read, we have to prepare people to be good thinkers. And to do that, you've got to give them a broad background.
One of the things I want to explore is some people are calling in now. I do want to explore it. I think sometimes it's important to hear personal stories.
Sure.
What you know, what brings people to a certain place, and what brings what brought the passion in Freeman Hrabowski to A, to learn, to want to learn, and B, to become a mathematician. So we and also to learn music at the same time. I want to talk about where that came from, but we have to take a very short break.
Okay.
When we come back from this very, very short break, we're going to let you talk about that. We're going to go to Cassandra, our first caller from Washington, D.C. So, Cassandra, please hold on. We will come right back to your call and explore the passion for learning that has to take place to create the world we need and how it happens at UMBC very specifically. 410-319-8888 is the number here. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. When we return at 410-319-8888 with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, we'll go right to the phones. Cassandra in Washington, D.C. You're the first caller up. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite looks at growing up in the city with the youth issue, featuring stories on child prodigies, the lives of teenagers, arrested adolescents, and how Baltimore can beat poverty by creating children's zones. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations. Visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com. for a list of drop locations. We are joined this hour by the president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, one of America's great educators, named by Time Magazine as one of the top 10 college presidents in America, Dr. Freeman Hrabowski. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Before we launch into the question I asked Freeman before we went to break, I promise we'd go right to the phones. And Cassandra in Washington, D.C., you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. I want to thank you for your programming. I work in Baltimore and live in D.C., and so I listen to you almost every night.
Thank you
for that.
Thank you.
And I'm calling with a comment for Dr. Hrabowski to tell you you're one of my heroes. Congratulations on this prestigious announcement. But even if you hadn't gotten it, I think the country is beginning to know, and if they don't already know, your great work with the university as well as students. I've heard some of your presentations in D.C., and I even know a couple of students who, because of your presentation, where you talked about your passion, came to your university and graduated. And it's just wonderful that you give back what you receive. I also know your books, and I continue to refer them to people. So just congratulations. I'm glad to be able to say that to you tonight.
I appreciate that so much, and I will pay you later.
Take good care.
Cassandra, thank you. Drive safely. 410-319-8888. Will, in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, I want to echo Cassandra's thanks to Mark for the show and my respect for Dr. Hrabowski's work and leadership all these years. I'm glad that he's getting the accolades he so much deserves. My question is the how do you interest students and how do you interest those who are in administration to support the arts and humanities. I think you made a great point of how important they are, but unlike the STEM areas, it's hard to quantify the results. Thanks.
Thank you.
It's a great question, and we have such incredibly talented students in the arts and humanities and social sciences, Linehan Artist Scholars and Drescher Humanities Scholars. And what I find is that they bring such passion to that work that the passion is contagious. Whether I'm going to a production in the theater or I'm getting a chance to listen to one of the musical productions, I'm always connecting to what's on the inside of those students. It's as if they are explaining the world as they see it. And it reminds me of what we do in any discipline across the curriculum. When people really believe in what they're talking about, whether it is the arts or in looking at social issues in the social sciences or understanding what it means to be human, what happens is that person brings his or her own perspective and story to the work and is able to explain challenging situations by using what you learn in that discipline to the situation. And in the arts, what I find is that people become elevated. I mean, they become inspired and they inspire other people, whether it's through the music or through a painting. And what's important is that in these difficult economic times, we must continue to talk about the importance of the arts, of the humanities, as we understand how we interact with each other, how we deal with the challenges of a child who can't read, or of poverty, or of kids who can't find the right school to attend. I mean, all of these are issues that we can understand better if we keep understanding more about ourselves as human beings. And the arts and humanities are doing just that for all of us.
Let me take another call, and then I'm going to come back to some questions for Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, president of UMBC, 410-319-8888, to join in on this conversation. And Joseph in Woodstock, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Mark.
Hi, Joseph.
Hello, Dr. Hrabowski. I'm a medical doctor myself. I'm a practicing emergency physician.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to ask you, what specific policy proposals or ideas could you recommend for the unemployment crisis? Because right now we're experiencing something we've never experienced before, where we have people who are highly educated, highly skilled, coming out of college, and they have these incredible student loans and debt burdens, and they can't find a job or they can't find employment commensurate with their degrees.
Sure.
And I just also wanted to ask him on a personal question. Because my daughter is in second grade at the Waldorf School, and it's a new experience for us. I was wondering if he has any experience with Waldorf School students at UMBC. Thanks very much. I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
Sure. First of all, the school has a great reputation. I'll have to check to see what students we have from there from the school, but I know it has a great reputation. And my advice to parents with children is read. Let them ask as many questions as they can. Get them involved in Legos, puzzles, the arts help. I mean, learning an instrument, all those are great things. But read, and write. I mean, more reading and writing children do, the more math problems they solve, the better they become. Now, in terms of the other problems that you mentioned, believe it or not, a lot of places are hiring. We had well over 100 employers on campus for our students just in the past month. A lot of the government places are hiring. A lot of students have already gotten jobs. The important thing for a college student to remember is get internships along the way. People who get internships or have practical experience on research are much more likely to get a great job or go on to grad school. I mean, about half of my students, almost 45%, go immediately to grad school. But those others who are going into the workforce, amazingly, I'm talking with students every day who are getting great interviews at companies in the Maryland area and beyond. It's important for parents to encourage students and for returning students to get involved in internships along the way. Now, for the country as a whole, I have been very impressed by a lot of the green jobs development and construction and job training. I was out in Los Angeles with a group recently looking at the job training they were giving people as they were getting their GEDs, as they were learning more math, and I see students often learning in classrooms as they were doing construction, working, developing construction skills. And I really do believe that we're going to need, and there are some of these programs popping up around the country, more opportunities for people to get jobs at different levels, with an understanding that people can go to college while they're working doing something else, or they can go to community colleges. And Maryland has a great community college system also. But for my students at UMBC, the exciting news is we're connecting them with a lot of employers, from Social Security Administration to Northrop Grumman to National Security Agency. You've got that Defense and Intelligence Network throughout the Baltimore-Washington corridor. You've got all kinds of social service agencies that are still looking to be supportive of people. So I would say the more connecting people do as college students earlier, the better the probability that when he or she graduates, that person can go immediately into a job.
So, Freeman Rabowski, going back to what I asked as before the break, I mean, and where the passion, your passion for learning came from, for and how you ended up in mathematics and still became a musician.
Let me tell you, and I am such a mediocre pianist, so you can start there.
You sound pretty good to me when you play. That's how bad I am.
You know, I always tell people, I may not be good at the piano, but I know who is good. I know I really enjoy listening and playing myself, I do. But this is the point I would make to you. I developed my passion for education because I had great family support. I had parents, hardworking, religious parents, who were always telling me to hold on to my faith, to work hard, that I had to do really well because I didn't know if the world was going to be fair, that I didn't have time to be a victim. Now, what's great about all of that is that I had this privilege of seeing them work five jobs between them. And that's one of our challenges, is to help parents to get the support they need so they can have jobs, so they can help their children to have jobs, and to see the importance of hard work. I mean, if I'm to answer your question with passion, I would say this. My students inspire me. Every day, I talk with students who have incredible stories of having overcome the odds, and they understand. And what I hear from students sometimes, I mean, the most amazing stories. Student was saying to me, Doc, my problem is I get into the library, and I should be working on my work, on my homework, and I just start reading, and I just enjoy it so much that I don't get to my work. What do I do? I mean, it's an incredible story, right? Because I have to tell them, focus, focus, focus. And you hear on my campus all the time, focus, focus, focus. But at the same time, I have to celebrate that student's passion, that student's lust for learning, that you can just explore. And so that's what we want. We want students who, yes, will get the job done and finish the project and do well on the test, but we want students to be curious and intellectually just interested in all kinds of things. And the more we can get children to be excited about learning and to love being smart, the better America will be. And that's what we have at UMBC. Students feel good about being smart. As I talked to my students in the Student Senate last night, we talked about ideas, and they were so incredibly interested in supporting the university in building the teaching and learning process. And I said to myself, I just wish every young person could have that kind of advantage background of somebody, whether they went to college or not, who taught this child to want to be smart, to want to learn, and to appreciate the value of hard work. Very old-fashioned values.
I'm curious, what did you talk about last night?
Oh, it was budget cuts. They were thanking us for working so hard to support them. We talked about, I made it very clear that the elected officials in this state have been working to support universities, that we are, while we are having our challenges, we are so much better off than many of the states where I go and speak, that our governor has worked very hard to keep the cost of education down. I mean, he's worked on that elected officials, the senators and the legislators are working to be as supportive of us with the governor as they can, and they appreciated that. They really did, because I was explaining that I think what makes Maryland special is that elected officials understand that the future of this state is directly tied to the quality of education, both K-12 and higher education. And it takes a long time to build up a strong higher education system. And that's what we have here. I mean, UMBC is just one example among many wonderful public and private institutions, four-year institutions and two-year institutions in Maryland. And people are working hard in these challenging times to make sure we can keep educating students, because when the economy turns around, and it is turning around, we need as educated a workforce as possible, not only because they can take jobs, but quite frankly, because they can help create jobs. You know, we have 55 companies on our campus last night. The students were talking to me about the job market and about the companies on campus. 55 companies on campus where large numbers of our students are working. Well, those are jobs, over 1,000 jobs that have been created because of brain power at UMBC, and that's what Maryland needs, and that's what students
Americans want to know, what can we do? And, you know, the Obama administration's new effort on innovation. Innovation and creativity will be the name of the game. And that comes not only from science and technology, that comes especially from the arts and humanities. It's how do you connect these disciplines? And that's a part of what we were talking about last night, because many students like both types of areas. They enjoy doing work in the arts and humanities. They enjoy science. And what we say at UMBC is you can connect those disciplines and really have an interesting career.
Now, what about the argument that, not the discussion, we don't seem to be having a great deal in America, because we are obsessed with every child going to college, and not that I'm opposed to people
right.
going to college, but this, I remember a couple of years back, a man on this program who was, owned a business, in the harbor in Baltimore, the working mm-hmm. harbor of Baltimore.
Right.
And he said, you know, being a machinist in today's world takes a lot of training.
Yeah.
You have to be computer savvy. It's not like the old days, your father's or grandfather's a machinist. It's a different
right.
world.
Yeah.
And that he said, but we can't find machinists. I mean, they're not training them. I mean, there are a lot of people. Well, let me start with A. The A part is, what about the millions and millions of people in America who don't have to go to a four-year college to become educated and decent citizens and make a living, but they can have a skilled trade?
I would agree that for many people, a traditional four-year education is not the first way to go. There are other opportunities, and we need to give people options. Sometimes a student just doesn't want to sit in a classroom, in a traditional classroom with a traditional discipline, when he or she's 18 or maybe even 25. And so jobs for the future, if people haven't looked at that work, if you go and Google jobs for the future, that group focuses nationally on opportunities, post-secondary opportunities is what we should be talking about. Post-secondary opportunities that in some cases will mean two-year institutions with all kinds of programs, some of whom will lead on to four-year degrees. Now, and what I say is this, and for some students, the idea of getting a trade, of working in an area where you can make a living, and with the opportunity later on maybe to come back to college. There are 54 million Americans who are working right now in this country who started college and didn't graduate. Well, for some, coming back and getting a four-year degree will be the answer. For others, having other kinds of post-secondary opportunities. So we do need to have a range of opportunities for students while we work to increase the number of college graduates. But we need to look at the needs and interests of every student, to not put them into a box, but to give them the possibilities. That would be my thinking. And I've thought about it for a long time now, and I'm convinced of that because I've helped students take different options. In some cases, they did not take the college option. Years later, they said, Doc, I'm ready to go back now. And then they did it. Some took the military option. Some took community college option with the idea of a two-year program, got a good job, started a family, and some are just as happy as they can be and doing really well. And so we need to be broad in our thinking about the possibilities for Americans.
We're talking with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, president of UMBC. The number here is 410-319-8888 to join in on this conversation about education, our future, about UMBC, about education in general. You can write to us here, steinershow@gmail.com or 410-319-8888. Get your calls in just a minute. And part of what makes a democracy work is an educated populace.
Yes.
And no matter what your occupation is.
Yes.
And we seem in some ways to be falling down on that job in our public school systems and even maybe in our private schools. I mean, I remember as a young man, which was a while back,
mm-hmm.
in school.
Well, we can both say that.
that we took part of the core you had to take was civics. You had to learn how the government functioned. Mm-hmm. You had to learn the history of the community you lived in. We actually took Baltimore City history.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up in the city.
Right.
Things like that. I mean, there's so many pieces of the puzzle that we have to have, you know, or whether it's that every student at least would learn how to play chess, even if you didn't end up being a chess player.
Sure.
But learning how to think that way, those are the kind of things that create critical thinking masses of people. I mean, critical thinking in masses of people that allow us to have a democracy.
And let me say something to give the audience some perspective. The fact is, Mark, when we were in school back in the 60s, for example, only about 11% of Americans had a college degree. We
right.
need to understand that.
Right.
Now, the difference was that you didn't have to have a college degree at that time or post-secondary education to get a good job. In Birmingham, you could work at Stock and Valve and Fittings. In Baltimore, at Bethlehem Steel.
Right.
Today, we need more post-secondary training to get better jobs. Now, we have made progress as a country. We have gone up to about 25% of Americans having college degrees now. It's about 32% of whites, and it's almost 20% of blacks. It's about 18%, up from about 3 or 4%, though, in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
The Asian population is the most educated, with about 55%. The Native American numbers are very small, and the fastest-growing population, Hispanic, unfortunately, we only have 11% with college degrees today. So we have made progress for every group. The problem is that the progress we were making in the 80s and 90s and through the first part of this decade may not be continued. Since 1965 and the Higher Education Act, every 10 years, a larger percentage of Americans were actually graduating from college. Every 10 years, 28 kids, people from ages 25 to 34, from age 35 to 44. For the first time, we don't seem to be making that progress, and so we are stagnated right here. And this is what the current administration is saying, that we have to do more to increase the numbers of people completing college if we are to compete against other countries where you have large numbers graduating from college. Just one example, we graduate about 1.5 million Americans per year with college degrees. Because of the sizes of the two countries, China and India, they're graduating about 7 million
wow.
per year.
Mm-hmm.
To put things in perspective of all types. So, and while numbers are not everything, we know we need to keep continuing to have more American families thinking about their kids getting college degrees. No doubt about that. And so we're going to see more and more efforts designed to do just that, to get college degrees for many and post-secondary opportunities for others.
Freeman, we have a ton of folks calling in. Let's get some of these callers.
Sure.
410-319-8888 as we talk with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, president of UMBC, University of Maryland, Baltimore County, becoming one of the finest institutions in the United States of America. 410-319-8888. Gerald, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening.
Thank
you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I'm 47. I'm very successful in the industry that I'm in. I'm an investigator.
Uh-huh.
Never went to college except for online.
Uh-huh.
One of the greatest hurdles, which is my greatest Achilles, is entering back into, yes, I want to go to college,
uh-huh.
but what a fear this is. What's one of the easiest ways to help someone to shoot over that hurdle so we can get this thing started?
Yeah, it's a great question.
First of all,
the fact that you're doing well right now says you've got some great skills. See, a lot of people got great high school skills, thinking skills. You speak well, if anybody, and so you're able to carry a good job. You want that degree because it could mean promotion. It could be just personal satisfaction. All you need to do is to contact the university, whichever. And for mine, it would just be umbc.edu. You start there and go to the homepage and go to admissions. And all of our campuses, if I'm to be fair to all the people in the area, if you go to their admissions area, you can write them a note, tell them just that story, and they will have someone get in contact with you. I know we will at UMBC. Every place likes getting returning students. This is what I like telling people. What you have, anybody who has been out working has excellent skills. You know how to get to work on time. You know how to finish a project. You've had to do some reading and some speaking. And believe me, all the obstacles of life strengthen people and get them ready for college. I've seen it over and over again.
That's right.
Because they've either been raising kids in a family or they've dealt with job situations. And so when they come back, they bring considerable experience. I think about 18% of my undergraduates are over 25, between 25 and 50, easily. 18%, almost 20%, and they do extremely well. I always see returning students coming back, worried a little bit about how you get started, will I be okay, will I be comfortable in the environment, and I'm telling you, you will. There are some states that have actually moved to all kinds of incentives, and I'm saying that the advantage of getting to a college campus is you get a chance to connect with all the partners of that campus, and so some of my returning students come back, start taking classes, they have one job, but they get a chance to start working with the Shriver Center and internships and with the Career Center, and they found other jobs in the meantime so that they can do the combination of going to school and working. So,
I mean, and it can happen. I mean, I have to say this on the air, Freeman, that my wonderful, lovely, brilliant 39-year-old daughter,
yes.
Chelsea, is returning. to UMBC.
Brilliant.
To get her degree in mathematics.
Yes, she is. And she's on it. I mean, I saw her with family and doing math. It's amazing to me what she can do. She is as stubborn and as smart as she can be. You tell her I said that.
I will tell her that. So she's on her way back.
I love it. That's great.
410-319-8888. Let's see who's next online here. Kelly, you're on the air.
Good evening, Mark, and good evening back. This is Kelly McCants Price, one of your former students.
Dr. Kelly McCants, how you doing,
yes,
Dr. McCants? I've seen you in
years.
I'm doing
great, thank you. I'm doing great. I was calling to tell you, first of all, thank you so much for all that you did to catapult me into the career that I am in. And what I wanted to know from you is, what exciting things are happening, or what exciting things do you see on the horizon at UMBC? For those of us who are alums who have not been back to campus recently, and for those of us who are interested in getting the next generation of students interested in attending UMBC?
It's a great question. You didn't know how to give me those softballs. I love it. Dr. McCann, I tell you, I knew her when she was a high school senior, and now she's a very prominent psychologist. Let me just say, most important, that we are really working to, the regions have put in the budget, and we are requesting from the governor the Arts and Humanities and Social Sciences building, and the governor's been being very supportive of us and working with us. That will be a major facility that will give a boost to the Arts and Humanities and Social Sciences at UMBC. We've been very fortunate to get new facilities in science and engineering, and yet 47% of our students are in these areas. And so that's very exciting to us, because we've got all these great programs to build the arts and humanities and social sciences, because students are interested in those areas and, quite frankly, get great jobs in those areas and doing many things. So that's one thing. The other point is that we're just getting more and more national visibility. You know that U.S. News named us number one up-and-coming national university.
That's
but
right.
Most significant, and Mark, you've heard me say this, we tied with Stanford University for fourth place in commitment to undergrad education. It was unheard of.
That's amazing.
The only public university in the top five. It was Dartmouth, Princeton, Yale, and then Stanford and UMBC. I mean, so, and that says so much about the investment of this state in public higher education, that we are in that category. And applications are up almost 60%.
So what's tuition?
Tuition is about, not quite $9,000. If you live on campus, it's not quite $16,000. And most freshmen live on campus. Half of undergraduates are on campus now. We're building more residence halls all the time. If you're from out of state, and we get more and more kids from New York, New Jersey, you're paying $25,000, $26,000. But most of our students are Marylanders. You know, when I talk about all these students from other countries, the parents have moved here at the undergrad level. So they're now, it's the new America. It's what we want America to be. America has always been a great place for people from all over the world. What makes our place special is you've got this international and domestic diversity with brilliant students who really enjoy learning, where the life of the mind is very active. You come on that campus, you feel it, you sense it, you can tell, regardless of race, that the students are excited about the humanities as they are excited about science.
Someone called in and didn't get through, but he was going to say something. He's one of your, must be one of your students or employees, something about the Institute for Fluorescence.
Yeah, he's an incredible one who's coming over from the University of Maryland Biotechnology Institute as we make these changes, and he's a brilliant, brilliant scientist, and I'm sorry he didn't get through, because he is doing incredible work, not only in the area, but in tech commercialization, and that's another part of it. I mean, it's his kind of brain power that leads to the kind of job creation that we're talking about in all these companies, and that's what makes a state and a nation great. It's the combination of these people with this strong backing in the humanities, who have the science and engineering in many cases like him, and who can come in and help create jobs, quite frankly. So building the economy.
Let's try to get sneak one other caller here or two, if we can fit them in before the end of the hour. Sean, you're on the air.
I just wanted to say that I'm a part-time lecturer at UMBC, and
uh-huh.
I teach English 291. And to the caller who was calling earlier about being a returning student, I just wanted to say how much I enjoy having them in class, and how much they contribute to the classroom environment is just tremendous. And for those students who might be hesitant about returning, I just wanted to really encourage them throughout the Baltimore listening area that they're just wonderful participants in class.
That's great to have you there, Sean.
Thank you, Sean. That's an inspirational message.
And there are all kinds of other programs like New Media and Communications and Aging Studies. That there's all these new programs that lead to great opportunities, by the way.
I wish we had more time, Freeman. It's always a joy to talk to you. Wish I could see you, but we'll see each other soon, I hope.
I'm looking forward to it. And come visit the campus sometimes and let everybody know. We would love to have them there. It's a place where people enjoy thinking and talking about ideas.
That's what's important. I'll see you soon, I hope.
Thank you.
Take care.
Take care now.
Dr. Freeman Hrabowski has been our guest here on this part of the Mark Steiner Show, of course, president of UMBC, an inspiring leader in our community who has put that college campus on the map nationally and internationally for students from everywhere and from all racial and ethnic backgrounds. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Women's Health for every stage of a woman's life, offering compassionate care and comprehensive obstetric and gynecological services from routine exams to specialized pelvic surgery. For more information, go to 1-800-492-5538 or log on to www.umm.edu/Women's Center. We will be right back to talk about all things political in our country at the moment and what's going on with Barack Obama, our economy, and more. So stay with us. We will be right back.